You have in hand the same handout again, Romans 1:23. Kai Laxon, Teen Doxa, or Doxon. To Thartu Theu, written here in blue if you can see it in the midst of everything else, Thartu Theu, in homoi homati, in the likeness of iconos, icons, Thartu, off Thartu, not corruptible, not dying, not decaying, not fading away, eternal. The A in front of it says not. In its place, for Thartu, without the ah, decaying, dying, fading, non-eternal, icons. Having known, as the little insert from the King James says, that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God showed it unto them, to everyone, beginning with the creation, God has left enough footprints and handprints, as we've said, to recognize His presence except for a willful refusal and rebellious desire to not have Him around. As I've said in this series, Adam and Eve duplicated. We want the whole garden without God. As I've repeated many times, R.C. Sproul's conclusion, atheism is a state of mind first, psychologically motivated rather than factually motivated. And blindly they will seek the facts to support the position already gained. They don't want a God because they don't want a master. We want to be masters of our own universe, masters of our own life, and we don't want to have to recognize that ultimately we're accountable to a supreme being and that He is our Lord and Master as the creator of the universe. We don't want that. God recognizes that trait. He sees the heart. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they're without excuse. Because when they knew God, they knew enough to recognize His being and His power. They glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain. And we've spent a lot of time on that word vain in the handout. When we were on that verse, Matthias is an evil bent of self-deception, self-serving evil thoughts. Thoughts designed to keep the self supreme. You know, I'm noted by those who work around me that I have zero tolerance for explanations and excuses. I have zero tolerance because that's what will take you to hell. I told you repeatedly the story of the little boy. He come running downstairs. His mother said, "What's wrong?" He says, "Mommy, there's a bear up in my room." I bet I've told you this 500 times. She said, "You go back upstairs and talk to Jesus about that bear." A few minutes later, he came back. She said, "What did Jesus say?" "Well, he thought it was a bear, too, when he first saw it." That tendency to justify We don't want to have someone that can see through our self-deceived, what is it the General Schwarzkopf said, bovine eschatology. They can see through our bovine eschatology. We don't want a God, but He is. That's why He finally said to Moses, what am I going to tell Pharaoh, the who sent me? Just I am that I am. We want to be I am that I am. He is, we're not. And vain in their imaginations, that comes from dialogue. Dialogos, dialogues, we get it from the same Greek word. The root is leg or logos, we get selection. We get logic. We get logistics. We get all kinds of words rooted on that have to do with choosing and saying, because the two roots go back down to choosing out from among other things by saying. They're self-serving choice of thought patterns and self-serving choice of words to defend what they have taken as their position. That is what God is fed up with. Because when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became self-serving, self-deceiving, in the word patterns of thought and mouth. And what God does do about it? What God do about it? The wrath of God, earlier verse said, when the gospel was revealed, at the same time, the wrath of God in the present tense begins to be fulfilled. Is being, now, here and now, turned loose. And the nature of that wrath now is not the fire to come. Their foolish heart was darkened. Again, you know the Greek, we handed it out. Their heart was darkened by the taking away of sense. A God sense is taken out. An insight where that within yourself is that which everyone apparently has a capacity to see is gone. A blind spot. A blind spot regarding God is an act of God's wrath that withdraws the capacity to see Him. And then, because of that, they become this. Professing themselves to be wise, they become morons. That's the cognate of the word in the Greek. They become morons. And as morons, having God's sense taken from them, they begin to construct. We've already got the clue with their vain imaginations, their matthias, evil self-deception, using words they construct in the likeness of icons, substitutes for God, before which we bow that are the product of their vain imaginations. Icons, anthropo, man, anthropo, various derivatives, and anthropology comes from that word. They construct icons of man, four-footed creatures, birds, four-footed creatures, and reptiles. As I said the last two Sundays, we immediately tune out, go around the water tanks, waiting for the next thing that is applicable to us. Because we don't carve out images and bow down to them of man. We don't worship icons or even the scientists are not asking us to worship icons of birds and reptiles and four-footed creatures. Oh, yes, they are. Now, at some point, and I prayed long and hard and debated before this Sunday, I don't want to lose Romans in the process of this endless subject illustrating vain imaginations. I just want to press on into Romans, and we could go on forever. Because the vain imaginations of these people is without end. And as when I was teaching on Ephesians, I waited for what I felt was a gestalt from the audience, that which so ran against tradition would create a nearly closed mind in most people. I remember the weeks I spent before I began to feel that the audience actually was beginning to understand, before the worlds were formed, God speaking, Logos, a word that chooses out from among those that he doesn't choose, actually chose. And your name was whispered before the worlds were formed. I worked weeks before I felt what Paul was saying settled in without a retranslation in your mind. There is some point that I want, and quickly, I prayed whether it would be today, to go beyond this verse, because I really do believe that it is sunk in. The fundamental message of these three verses, 21, 22, and 23, that if you trifle, whether you're a heathen, the days of Paul had none of the scientific knowledge we now have, whether you're a heathen that just looks out at the night sky or the mountains and the changing weather and the seasons and the day and the night, or whether you're a sophisticated scientist that has probed to the edge of the universe or in the micro world to the realm of uncertainty, in some primordial soup of quarks and various other imaginary, really. Nobody's ever seen them. Nobody's seen an atom. Just the effects of their presence postulates their existence. Neutrinos, the smallest particles that mathematical deductions concluded must be there, sunk deep in the earth, with protections analogous to that which protects the outflow of rays from radioactive power plants, that only neutrinos will go through. You only see the effect of their passing. Whether you go out there or here, to the magnificence of the never-ending universe, supposedly expanding, like little sequence on the outside of a balloon as you blow it up. Or you go into the micro world, as I said, and find a cell that the evolutionists thought might help them with the breakthroughs in DNA and gene studies. And they find just one cell has got pre-programmed information for self-replicating and the job that cell is assigned to do. Pre-programmed information in that tiny cell that if we were to analogize to programming a computer and print the pages out, one cell would fill the 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica to just spill out the information that is necessary to direct the activity of that one cell. And how many cells are in your body? Pre-programmed. Paley's watchmaker, if you stumble along on a mountain path and you kick a rock, it doesn't necessarily suggest any intelligence-directed activity around there. But if you suddenly kick the dirt, and here's a watch, and you pick it up, And it keeps time perfectly. It's hard to believe that that spewed out of a volcano and that the atoms and molecules and particles just assembled themselves into that fine Swiss watch. And of course, the vain imaginations of the evolutionists, particularly Dawkins, their parrot, he's good at name-calling those who believe in the creation, but I've yet to find a creationist that comes up with fool thoughts matching his. He then responds by talking about the blind watchmaker. And he works with his computers, and he's seeing things like a child looking at a Rorschach test. And he can just sort of connect dots. And all of a sudden he sees an insect, or he sees some other biomorph. And then he chooses the one that he likes. It's an insect. It's got 8 legs like a spider, but these are being created by chance with the dots. And then he chooses the ones that appeal to him, and he assembles more dots. And here, like a free association painting, he's producing by chance. All the time ignoring the fact that the computer isn't doing this without the program. It can't do it. You can't set monkeys down. They might type an intelligent sentence if you gave them enough bananas and let them type. But they will not write a history of the world. They will not write a Shakespearean play. It won't happen in billions of 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 billions around the water tank monkeys. I said last Sunday when I ended I would get into information theory. Don't have to. We'll find this book and get it for you. Put it in my bookstore. William Dembski, Intelligent Design. Intelligent Design. They cannot ignore the fact that these life cells start out with the program. And I, last Sunday, gave you one illustration of the way in which proteins achieve a certain purpose. This is intelligent design. Before Darwin and before the scientism that produced the tunnel of today, the Bible still had some respect on the world stage. Little doubt of what religionists created their own problem by being closed-minded and not open to the truth. The reason I take the kids to the museums, God's not going to fall off His throne because of their questions. And all it does is set them up with a series of messages. When they come to the cathedral, and you who listen to me as parents can take care of their faith. I'm not afraid of truth, neither is God. But scientism has captured the mind with the tunnel, as we have said, where they say the only source of truth is the world that we see, and the only method of obtaining truth, the scientific method, and that floor of scientism that turns science into a religion that goes beyond the facts and requires a faith the same as Christianity is denied, as faith in their theories supplants any faith in what God has said in His revelation, and the educational system has succumbed, and the legal system has succumbed, and the brainless media just sit there and parrot it as though it were facts. Icons substituted for God. I want to bring this to a close so I can move on in Romans. As long as I can feel that you understand the danger of trifling with whatever knowledge you have. God has a reaction now that when you turn your back deliberately on whatever revelation of God you have, from general creativity to special revelation, He doesn't just sit and take it idly anymore. From the day of the gospel, He has been executing a wrath that takes away sense, until that wondrous treasure, more precious than anything, the capacity to respond to God and to hear His call and to see and recognize His presence, is taken from you. And you become a fool, a moron, professing to be wise. Icons, there's one. Icons in the form of man. That's what it says. That's the first icon. Think we don't have icons? It's in every textbook. This is my ancestry. This is your ancestry. From a knuckle-walking ape. And we've been through. I could spend the next 10 years on the fallacies behind that icon. The inability to find an ancestor. The fights in the scientific world, including the leakies, because we now have the so-called later icon, the end of the evolutionary line, showing up in rocks by their own dating method that are earlier than the father. In other words, I can give you illustration after illustration where the son and the grandson and the great-grandson is born before the father, yielding to the fact that this might be my great-great-grandfather, this knuckle-walker back here. We showed you pictures of the Piltdown man, a total hoax, the Java man. They don't tell you that some of the reconstructions in the museums come from a little bone of the skull and a jaw, and depending on the way you move the jaw, you get a total different look. It's snake oil salesmen. Icons. What kind of icons? Let's see if I can find the page that just sort of summarizes the icons. This whole book, we got it in the bookstore. Get it? I think all families should have this book by Jonathan Wells, Icons of Evolution, Science or Myth, because it illustrates, as well as any book I know, professing themselves to be wise, they become morons, and a God-sense departed. How intelligent people can continue to pursue and fight for that which the literature and the science itself has already discredited proves they've become fools. As we have seen, the icons of evolution misrepresent the evidence. One icon, the Miller-Urey experiment, which the media, in Fantasia, that beautiful animated movie from Disney, the media buying into scientism, starts out as the explanation for creation, whereas this icon postulated an oxygen-free universe, when there is absolute opposite proof that the earliest rocks and every proof of the universe, it always had oxygen on this earth. And if they had put oxygen in the little tube in which they tested this experiment, they would have met their creator quickly. But to do the experiment, you had to pull the oxygen out. This book blows that icon apart. Gives a false impression that scientists have demonstrated an important first step in the origin of life. One, the four-winged fruit fly. That's the second icon. Is portrayed as though it were raw materials for evolution, namely a mutation that produced four wings on the fly, trying to demonstrate that natural selection and mutations, when mutations tend to degenerate, not improve, and an accidental chance of a mutation and then natural selection, because the mutation improves the individual and they are more survivable, thus fitter to survive than they were before the mutation. So the before the mutation, organisms die out and this new mutation moves on. The only time they've been able to show a mutation that happens is the four-winged fruit fly. And it's heralded as proof of evolution, but it's a hopeless cripple. Evolutionary dead. He can't fly. Like mutations, it made it worse. Three icons, vertebrate limbs, Archaeopteryx, and Darwin's finches, show actual evidence, but are typically used to conceal fundamental problems. The finches are cyclical. Oh, yeah. A drought comes along, or a rainy season that determines the accessibility of what the finches feed on, and therefore the ones that have a long bill survive under certain circumstances. And after a while, you see a little cyclical change of more long bills, and then there's a sudden change of the weather, and they go back. Evolution never has you going oscillating. It's always been natural selection goes forward. The finches oscillate, and they're still oscillating. There's been no permanent evolution. They're still oscillating. We covered some of these, so I'm not going to waste time on them. Three, the tree of life, fossil horses, and human origins are incarnations of concepts masquerading as neutral descriptions of nature. Same thing with the horses. The little horse crops up later than the big horses when it's supposed to work the other way. And they finally change tree of life and have them going every direction. Fossil horses, human origins, and two icons, Haeckel's embryos, that we showed you in an earlier message were fraudulently drawn. Just fraudulently drawn. And the peppered moths on tree trunks are fakes. They don't nest on tree trunks. And it was staged, even with pinned moths stuck on the tree. All of this. Fraud is a dirty word. In a 1982 book, Betrayers of the Truth, Fraud and Deceit in the Halls of Science, William Broad and Nicholas Wade distinguished between deliberate fraud and unwitting self-deception. Conscious faking of data is an example of deliberate fraud, relatively rare, like the moths and the embryos. Unconscious manipulation of data by researchers convinced that they already know the truth is an example of the latter. They know the truth. Don't bother me with the facts unless they support it. There's a continuum between fraud and self-deception. In most cases, misrepresentation falls somewhere between. Some textbook writers, such as Douglas Fuchima, may not even know that one or more of the icons of evolution are false. I want to read something here. One of these textbook writers who's writing false facts, he says, we want to get across the general idea. So the fact that we're portraying a few things that are false is unimportant, really. We're trying to get across the general idea. That's why your textbooks will still have these fraudulent pictures in them. It is fraud. And I'm trying to find somewhere here where they said that it was murder, the equivalent of murder. Convictions justify open falsehoods. No, they don't. I am not wanting to continue illustrating and giving so much time to these frauds and liars. I just want it to settle in that people become a kind of insane. They promote with idiocy what they know not to be true. Well, you want some more illustration? All right, here's a little pamphlet. by the Institute for Creation Research. The purpose, whether atheism or humanism, and Hubert Smith would call it scientism, the purpose is to eliminate a personal God from any active role in the origin of the universe and all its components, including man. This is a deliberate purpose, illustrating the truth of what I'm drawing out of Romans 1. This is a deliberate purpose. Having known, knowing better, they are determined to turn from God, not thank Him, not glorify Him, and substitute the icon products of their mind in His place. And it is a purposeful, never-ending attack on God and His presence in this universe. And we, in the tunnel, having been subjected to a generation that's conquered education through John Dewey, and law, and medicine and education via Leipzig University in Germany, having been conquered, we are growing up as a generation, or the generation I grew up in and the present one, in a tunnel of brainwashing, deliberate, anti-God state of mind. And we just lay down and allow the spiritual and mental rape to occur without a cry. The cry is, and I've seen many of these books that are on the creation side, refer to Romans 1, 22, and 23. But never in the 2,000 years and all the commentaries written on the book of Romans has anyone done what we're doing here, illustrating it as the result of God literally taking out of them the God sense. This is Romans for the 21st century. That God, who in the first century had a wrath for those that would not recognize His presence from the simple creation that's seen with the natural eye, these modern scientists, having reached a terminal point still unexplained in the macro and in the micro, will not stop their pursuit of somehow we will prove there is no need of a God. Because their sense is gone. And with more to go on for which to praise God and to thank God than those without the modern knowledge, there is still this obsession to remove the Creator. The core of humanistic philosophy is naturalism, the proposition that the natural world proceeds according to its own internal dynamics without divine or supernatural control or guidance, and that we human beings are creations of that process. It is instructive to recall that the philosophers of the early humanistic movement debated as to which term more adequately described their position, humanism or naturalism. The two concepts are complementary and inseparable. I said we'll get the book, Intelligent Design. Let me show you where some of this starts and bore you a little with my field, which is philosophy. And it's well stated by Dembski in Intelligent Design. The prince of this world stays very alert. I've often said to you, revivals are very interesting to study across the world. I still remember landing in Manila, and all I had to say was take me to the Christ is the answer, church. I went back there several times. Founded in a great revival, miraculously led by Lester Summerall. And Lester and I became close friends for many years. Everybody knew where that church was. But as the news of the revival spread, then everybody that wanted to get on the bandwagon felt that to be a successful evangelist, they had to go to Manila, because that's where the action was. But by the time they got there, the devil had built his defense. There's always, because Satan is not omniscient, the wind bloweth where it listeth as a type of the Holy Spirit, and God will perform an act and thrust his hand into an area, and instantly the devil with his forces will go on the defensive, and it's harder to repeat. The prince of this world knows his time is limited. I think it's not without significance that as the King James took shape in 1610, 11, and through the 30s, that about the same time, let me give you the dates, between 1650 and 1850, Spinoza and Schleiermacher altered completely the fundamental and rational foundations of the Christian faith. You may think I'm being mystical. Okay, think what you will. But the Bible, the King James, as the culmination of the series of Bibles you will see from the work that was the first translations after the Greek manuscripts became available, from Tyndale through the Coverdale, and through the Matthew, and through the Bishop's Bible, and the Great Bible, and the Geneva Bible, the King James, to this day, has profoundly affected the ability to preach the gospel, and has covered the world with the power of its phraseology, and even though I'm working with the Greek many times, I will go back to the King James as the basic foundation and point of departure because of its familiarity. Well, isn't it interesting? The devil went on the attack, and as he always does, his most effective attack is to come inside wolf in sheep clothing. Spinoza. You remember I told you concerning these scientists? Albert Einstein asked about God. Remember I told you? He said, I believe in Spinoza's God. Remember that? I remember that. Who was Spinoza? Spinoza's reputation of miracles, I don't tell you, Spinoza's reputation of miracles occurs in his Tractatus Theologico-Politicus. And it was probably the most controversial book published in 1670. It became a great object of vituperation. Am I boring you? As Brad Gregory describes the work, Spinoza's Tractatus Theologico-Politicus provoked some of the most violent reactions to any published work in the 17th century. It appeared in 1670 or perhaps late in 69. Though its title page indicated it was published in Hamburg, it had in fact been printed in Amsterdam. Though published anonymously, the work and identity of its author quickly became known throughout Europe. The philosopher had simply expressed his views on the relationship between philosophy, religion, and politics. From the responses to the work, however, it is clear that these did not amount to just more opinion among others in a period rife with religious controversy. At the time of its publication, Christian orthodoxy was united in its condemnation of the Tractatus. The Reformed Synod of North Holland called for an official ban on the book. In 1674, a Dutch correspondent of Spinoza's published a work entitled Refutation of the Blasphemous Book called Tractatus Theologico Politicus, a title that speaks for itself. The Dutch correspondent went on to tell John Colaris, a Lutheran biographer of Spinoza, that the Tractatus was full of curious but abominable discoveries, the learning and inquiries whereof must needs have been fetched from hell. Every Christian, nay, every man of sense, ought to abhor such a book. The author endeavors to overthrow the Christian religion and baffle all our hopes which are grounded upon it. The Germans, by comparison, made these Dutch attacks on the Tractatus look mild. A work published anonymously at Cothen in 1702 entitled Presentation of Four Recent Worldly Philosophers refers to the abominable doctrines and hideous errors which this shallow Jewish philosopher, as if I may say so, bleeped into the world. Although he uses the S word. In other words, he's saying that this book came out of the wrong orifice of Spinoza. Spinoza's Critique of Miracles was not fundamentally new. It has a long history. Let me skip along here. Cicero, 106:43, had a critique of miracles in the following words. Quote, for nothing can happen without cause, nothing happens that cannot happen, and when what was capable of happening has happened, it may not be interpreted as a miracle. Consequently, there are no miracles. Now, here's your perfect case of professing themselves to be wise morons. Want to hear this again?
Yes, sir.
For nothing can happen without cause. Now that's his first premise. Nothing happens that cannot happen. All around the water tanks. And when what was capable of happening has happened, it may not be interpreted as a miracle, because nothing can happen that can't happen, and nothing can happen without a cause, and if it's capable of happening, it is capable of happening, and therefore if it happens, it's because it was capable of being happening, and therefore it's not a miracle. We therefore draw this conclusion, what was incapable of happening never happened, and what was capable of happening is not a miracle. Got that? Spinoza essentially took Cicero's Critique of Miracles, cleaned it up, and put it in his religious philosophy. Since nothing, and this is Spinoza, since nothing is necessarily true, save by the divine decree, it quite clearly follows that the universal laws of nature are merely God's decrees. Following from the necessity and perfection of the divine nature, so if anything were to happen in nature contrary to her, nature's universal laws, it would also be necessary that it be viewed as contrary to the decree, intellect, and nature of God. Or if anyone were to maintain that God performs some act contrary to the laws of nature, he would at the same time have to maintain that God acts contrary to his own nature. Than which nothing could be more absurd. Thus, you may have created it, God, but it's your work, and you put these laws in it, and you're really not necessary anymore because you are disallowed from changing what's here. And that's why Einstein got so bothered that his own laws of general and special relativity and his views of time and space require a starting point, which became the basis for the Big Bang Theory. Now, in all of these things, as I have traversed the land of the theories that they offer in substitute for God and His Word, and in the absence of knowledge of God's Word, though most of them have it, a substitute for the thought of a creator in this marvelous universe, all we have had is philosophic theories spun in every direction. Do I believe, you may want to know, do I believe in the Big Bang Theory? No. The church jumped on it in a hurry because they felt that since Newton's time had postulated eternal existence of things, they used that to believe in eternal God, but they fell trapped into Spinoza's philosophy, and the Big Bang instantly gave the theory of the first cause, that there must be a causer, and therefore there must be a God. You don't need a Big Bang to believe in God. I have said and mocked it, there must be a Big Banger for the Big Bang to have occurred. I don't believe in the Big Bang. The Big Bang is still some chance diffusion. You don't explode a hand grenade and get order. Second law of thermodynamics. You do not have an explosion and produce order. I'm jumping around a lot because I haven't time to do everything to demonstrate all these fools. I said I'd do this many, many messages back. In this little book, The Creator and the Cosmos, by Hugh Ross, Ph.D., who is a marvelous defender of creation by an eternal God. He has a chapter called The Just Right Universe. Now, I'm going to try to get this book for the bookstore, but I'm going to just read a little bit. Now, if I can show you, it goes on page after page. 1, 2, 3 full pages, two of them being partial. So there's four pages, but two are partial, making a total of three. More than 24 parameters for the universe must have values falling within narrowly defined ranges for life of any kind to exist. Now, we've talked about the statistics of 10 to 60 zeros or 10 to 150 zeros or 10 to 50 zeros in probability. Very small variation wipes out life. A strong nuclear force constant, if larger, no hydrogen. The nuclei essential for life would be unstable. If smaller, no elements other than hydrogen. Now, we talked to you when we were in quantum mechanics. I don't expect you to remember any of this. I'm after just one simple cognitive gestalt reaction that something's been removed from these geniuses' brain and mindset. They will pursue the most ridiculous paths as long as they can rule God out of the equation. Weak nuclear force, I talked to you about strong and weak nuclear forces down in quantum mechanics. One of them that keeps them from imploding, another keeps them from exploding. All these, the four major forces, they haven't figured out gravity yet. Weak nuclear force constant, that's what we have in our universe. If larger, too much hydrogen converted to helium in a Big Bang. Hence, too much heavy material element made by star burning, no expulsion of heavy elements from stars. If smaller, too little helium produced from Big Bang, hence too little heavy material made by star burning, no expulsion of heavy elements from stars. 3, gravitational force constant. If larger stars would be too hot, burn up too quickly, too unevenly. If smaller stars would remain so cool, the nuclear fusion would never ignite, hence no heavy element production. Electromagnetic force constant. 4 pages. And of course the book dealt with each of these concepts, that if there's the slightest variation. In other words, God didn't just make this earth habitable. It didn't evolve by itself, if evolution could be taken for granted, into its present state. Every part of this universe had to be in the balance it is in. Another, 4 pages of the balance for just this earth. Those other 4 pages that I kept going had to do with all the elements of the universe. I think I told you one Sunday the statistical probability of one star forming by chance. And yet, that's the source of all life, this one star, the sun, on this earth, as the primary source of life. But everything else is also involved. Galaxy type. Evidence for the design of the galaxy, sun, earth, moon system for life support. If two elliptical, because the galaxies are elliptical, you've seen in their science books the spirals of different shapes of galaxies. If the galaxy type is two elliptical, star formation would cease before sufficient heavy element buildup for life chemistry. If too irregular, radiation exposure on occasion would be too severe and heavy elements for life's chemistry would not be available. You ever heard of supernova eruptions? If too close, life on the planet would be exterminated by radiation. If too far, not enough heavy element ashes would exist for formation of rocky planets. If too frequent, life on the planet would be exterminated. If too infrequent, not enough heavy element ashes would be present for the formation of rocky planets. If too late, life on the planet would be exterminated by radiation. If too soon, white dwarf binaries, parent star distance from center of the galaxy, number of stars in the planetary system, parent star birth, parent star age, parent star mass, parent star color, parent star luminosity, surface gravity, escape velocity, distance from parent star, inclination of orbit, orbital eccentricity, axial tilt, we're talking about the Earth, rotation period, rate of change in the rotation period, age of the planet, magnetic field, thickness of the crust, everything in perfect balance. Oh, David cried out, "What is man that thou art mindful of him?" That's what God's looking for. Oh, we're a little peanut in the universe. We're a peanut in the universe for which the universe was designed. A fool, heathen, in the first century, couldn't quite conceive that. With a flat earth idea and thought himself the center of the earth, he was closer to understanding the importance of what God has provided. But now that we know as much as we know from science, you've got to have sense pulled out. To think that could happen by chance. Their response, well, we're here and it happened and that's the way it is and therefore it had to happen by chance. And therefore it's not miraculous and needs no creator. Because it was capable of happening or it wouldn't have happened. Spinoza took over the mindset and gave a way out. Am I boring you? You read on in this little pamphlet. Of course we can't prove there isn't a God. The evolutionists say. Therefore, they must believe it, this little book says. They can't prove there's no God, but they believe there's no God. And they can't prove it, it's a matter of belief. You can't prove there isn't, you can't prove a negative. There is no proof there is no God, they start out eliminating Him. They believe it. It's an article of faith. That makes it a religion. The atheistic nature of evolution not only admitted, but insisted upon by most of the leaders of evolutionary thought. Ernest Mayr, for example, says, Darwinism rejects all supernatural phenomena and causations. A professor in the Department of Biology at Kansas State University says, even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such a hypothesis is excluded from science because it's not naturalistic. Eminent scientific philosopher and ardent Darwin and atheist Michael Ruse has acknowledged that evolution is their religion. Quote, evolution is promoted by its practitioners as more than mere science. Evolution is promulgated as an ideology, a secular religion, a full-fledged alternative to Christianity with meaning and morality. Evolution is a religion. This was true of evolution in the beginning, and it's true of evolution still today. In the realm of cosmic evolution, naturalistic scientists depart even further from experimental science, the tunnel of scientism. Manufacturing a variety of evolutionary cosmologies from esoteric mathematics and metaphysical speculation, and you've seen that, A Brief History of Time and all the different cosmologies. Socialist Jeremy Rifkin has commented on this remarkable game. Cosmologies are made up of small snippets of physical reality that have been remodeled by society into vast cosmic deceptions. Am I boring you? Speaking of the deceptions, he made the following remarkable statement. We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. In spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated commitment to materialism, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Am I boring you? Evolution is not science. Evolution is tirades notwithstanding. It is a philosophic worldwide view, a philosophic worldview, nothing more. Evolution must, they feel, explain everything. A theory that explains everything might just as well be discarded since it has no real explanatory value. Of course, the other thing about evolution is that anything can be said because very little can be disproved. Experimental evidence is minimal. They don't have a missing link. They can't find any links. They don't have any basis for the icon of the geologic column that's in front of you. That small little insert shows you that every single kind of so-called dated earth rests upon the Cambrian to some extent, where the explosion of life first burst into the fossil record. But the worst problem, I'm going to add one more religion viewpoint. I told you about this little book that dates, in other words, it's an autobiography of the, or a biography rather, of the growth of the geologic column, stage by stage. Starting with Lyell, the father of geology. When Lyell wrote his Principles of Geology, still when I was in school, the classic, I did an undergraduate unit major in geology, preparing for what I then thought I would do, go to Berkeley, University of California, in political geography. And geology was required as a basis. I subsequently changed, went to Stanford, and started over in philosophy. But Lyell father of geology, as Agassiz, the father of the so-called Ice Age. When Lyell wrote his Principles of Geology, he had at least two goals. One was to present an alternative to the catastrophic concept of Earth history advanced by Cuvier and widely proclaimed by many naturalists in the early 19th century. Because the Bible speaks of a worldwide deluge, and as I told you, this wonderful but highly documented and difficult to read but classy study on flood geology lays a case more eloquent than the fanciful ideas of the Darwinists that all the fauna and geologic sedimentary strata could have been caused by one great flood. And I misspoke last Sunday when I talked of lava flows in the Colombian Plateau, 5 miles deep, 5,000 feet deep. But that is still more than enough to exhaust all the known volcanoes in the world. That great plateau in western Idaho, northern Oregon, and eastern Washington. And the floods in the so-called Scablands, and there are hundreds of pages of studies and research that a major flood carved out those impossibly deep canyons in a matter of 2 or 3 days, and what was called the greatest flood that ever hit mankind. And it's been for 30 years in the literature, but ignored by the slow uniformitarianism of that basis for scientism, that the Earth must be these billions of years old, and the sun must be 4.5 or 6 billion years old, and things must have gone along at the same rate that the present is the key to the past. And I think on that geologic column, if you look on the left, the years, and you look in the center, the depth of the rocks that are attributed, you're going to find that 0.02 of a meter per year is the gradual accumulation, which wouldn't cover a fly, much less cover up a dinosaur or a mastodon or an alligator. But don't bother me with the facts, because Lyell had two things he must accomplish. Present an alternate to catastrophic shake-ups of this earth. Now, I believe in an old earth. I'm not going to believe the dating methods. I'm not going to believe that it's had this gradual development. I'm not going to believe the 4.6 billion, because I believe in catastrophes. And I believe from the Bible that there's a vast gap of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. And I'm not going to take the time today, because I've referred to it in many miracles. But Satan was on this earth before he fell, as proved by Isaiah and Ezekiel. And yet we encounter him in Genesis 1 after he fell. And Jeremiah saw a cataclysm strike this earth before there was any man. And it became, using the same Hebrew words, a waste and a desolation. And between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2 is a vast gulf of time. Whatever went on in those past eons, nobody knows. But at the time of beginning the recreation of Genesis 1:2, the Spirit was hovering over the waters of the deep. And thus, the earth, among other things in this great becoming a waste and desolation, covered by water. I don't know how old before that. I do believe in the Noah flood. Whether or not it covered every square inch of this globe, I don't know. Because just as Joshua said the sun stopped because he's reporting his visual impression, not a scientific pronouncement. God was not speaking through him. He was speaking from his view. Thus, the writers of the Bible viewed the earth as totally covered, and only this one family escaped. Yet, uniformly, in all the legends, in all countries of primitive peoples, they tell stories of a great flood and a great catastrophe, and being hidden in a cave somewhere, and everything was dark, and they come out and everything's dark. And the waters are receding. I don't know whether anyone survived. I have no basis for believing that, except these legends in multiple societies and the strange historical backgrounds of some of the primitive cultures just beginning to be respected in Latin America, for example, in Central America. But there was a great flood until I find a biblical basis for anyone escaping, I hold judgment back. The biblical view, everything was destroyed in this flood. The biblical view is multiple catastrophes. Man's gotten worse and was better. I spent a lot of time on TV about the possible canopy theory proposed first by Pasadena scientist. All I'm saying is the Bible requires periodic catastrophes, which would throw any dating game off. Violent upheavals, volcanic activity, possible tilting of the axes, cracking of the earth's crust because the waters rushed up from the deep, as well as the heavens breaking open, and if there was a canopy, then those that were not exposed to the sun and the earth having a every day springtime effect, and without the harmful age-producing of the rays from the sun protected by this hothouse effect, if that canopy theory is correct. Certainly the Bible suggests great changes. Longevity of life after the flood began to deteriorate. You must accept catastrophes if you accept the Bible record. That's what Lyell set out to destroy, an alternative to the catastrophic concept. The second was to position geology upon principles, and the principle was uniformitarianism, that as is, always was. He set out with a mission. He set out to rebuke and destroy any belief in catastrophe, and he set out to rebuke any kind of creative intrusion into this earth. Things have always been as they are, culminating in Carl Sagan, or Sagan, the cosmos is all there is, all there ever was, and all there ever will be. God is in the cosmos. One more? You sure? This is Henry M. Morris. What is creation science? Given the facts of our existence, this is a New Age evolutionist. Given the fact our existence seems quite improbable, more miraculous perhaps than the seven-day wonder of Genesis, the physicist Freeman Dyson of the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton once remarked, the universe in some sense must have known we were coming. Prior to these modern developments, Sir Julian Huxley, arguably the leading architect of the neo-Darwinism system, had written an influential book called Religion Without Revelation, and had become, with John Dewey — I did my doctorate under Larry Thomas, who was the leading spokesperson for Dewey's philosophy of experimentalism and the resulting progressive education that dominates and did dominate from the 50s onward until it began to be recognized in the late 70s that there was problems. But John Dewey totally took over, and his philosophy of progressive education in America, the chief founder of the American Humanist Association. As first director general of UNESCO, he formulated the principles of what he hoped would soon become the official religion of the world. Thus, the general philosophy of UNESCO should, it seems — am I boring you? Do you realize the church world doesn't realize they're living in this tunnel? And until someone starts blowing holes through it, it will stay the tunnel. Thus, the general philosophy of UNESCO should, it seems, be a scientific world humanism, global in extent, and evolutionary in background. The unifying traditions into a single common pool of experience, awareness, and purpose is the necessary prerequisite for further major progress in human evolution. Accordingly, although political unification in some sort of world government will be required for the definitive attainment of this state, unification in the things of the mind is not only necessary also, but can pave the way for other types of unification. I remember when I was doing my doctorate, there was a moral issue between what's called traditionalists and reconstructionists. And the moral issue was, do we, as they were cramming progressive education down our throat, do we, the elite, the educated — this was the viewpoint of the professors — do we, the elite, do we have a duty, a moral duty, to only pass on to the kids that we teach the traditions that society accepts? Or do we have a moral duty, because we are elite and we have — this is fascism embodied — we have a knowledge that the masses don't have, and thus do we have a duty to reconstruct society in our image, along the superior lines? Are we just going to pass on dead tradition? Or do we have a moral duty, as the genius profess to be wise morons — that's what I call them — do we have a moral duty, because of our superior knowledge, to reconstruct society in our image? That's self-worship incarnate. And the reconstruction is won. I went out of there knowing, even at the master's level, I couldn't get my general secondary teacher's credential, which I did, without embracing progressive education as a method, as if you could separate the method from the philosophy. And when I was doing my college degree, there was not a single class in educational philosophy below the doctoral level in any school in America. I had to become a candidate for the doctor's degree to have my first class in educational philosophy and learn the philosophy of experimentalism that stood underneath progressive education, which, since we're reconstructionists, let's get an emotive name. Everybody wants to be progressive. And the experimentalism is recloaked in progressive education. There's a war going on, folks. And God prophesied it in His Word. These are men and women obsessed to do away with God. And all of these so-called I believe in an old earth. I don't believe in the old earth they're talking about. I don't believe in their dating methods. I've already knocked holes in those. But let's show you how these scientism fanatics act when somebody challenges them. This is from Richard Milton, Chattering the Myths of Darwinism. I only got 7 minutes, so stay with me. Putting to death the bearer of bad tidings, activity usually associated with more uninhibited Roman emperors or Eastern despots. But messenger shooting can be just as common in the scientific and academic circles when the bad news concerns one of science's sacred cows. One messenger who published findings that challenged the received wisdom on geological history and who was mugged by his fellow scientists for his trouble was Emanuel Velikovsky, who wrote the 1950 book Worlds in Collision, and it caused a virtual panic in the academic community. Velikovsky proposed that a near collision between the Earth and other planets of the solar system caused catastrophic geologic events in the Earth's history, and that most of the major features of the Earth's crust are testimony to these events. He also sought to establish a short time scale for the Earth's history. His treatment was so shameful by the community of academics, Professor Albert DeGraja of New York University in the journal American Behavioral Science observed on Velikovsky's book, "Give rise to a controversy in scientific and intellectual circles about scientific theories and the sociology of science, Dr. Velikovsky's historical and cosmological concepts, bolstered by his acknowledged scholarship, constituted a formidable assault on certain established theories of astronomy, geology, and historical biology, and on the heroes of those sciences, Newton himself and Darwin being challenged, and indeed the general orthodoxy of an ordered universe. What must be called the scientific establishment rose in arms not only against the new Velikovsky theories, but against the man himself. Efforts were made to block the decimation of his ideas, even to punish supporters of his investigations. Universities, scientific societies, publishing houses, the popular press were approached and threatened. Social pressure and professional sanctions were invoked to control public opinion. There is little doubt that in a totalitarian society, not only would Dr. Velikovsky's reputation have been at stake, but also his right to pursue his inquiry, and perhaps his personal statement, personal safety. As it was, the establishment succeeded in building a wall of unfavorable sentiment around him. To thousands of scholars, the name Velikovsky bears the taint of fantasy, science fiction, and publicity. Geologists and astronomers were so virulently opposed to Velikovsky's book that they threatened to boycott the scientific textbooks of his publisher, Macmillan. This forced the firm to turn Velikovsky's work over to another publisher, Doubleday, who was not involved in textbook publishing and hence not susceptible to academic blackmail. Today, only 40 years later, a concept closely similar to Velikovsky's is widely accepted by many geologists, that the major extinction of the dinosaurs at the end of the Cretaceous, and possibly other extinctions, another one on their schedule, 265 million years ago, the dinosaurs 65, was caused by collision with a giant meteor or even asteroid. He was so badly treated, he spent 5 years researching another book, Earth in Upheaval. And now that the evolutionists are being forced to accept some form of cataclysms, there's no denying mastodons, mammals, birds from diverse places, all in piles, killed instantly, billions of fish killed and in a rock with their bodies excoriated. There's no denying cataclysms have hit this earth. There's no denying that the so-called building of mountains that's supposed to take a long time didn't happen the way the uniformitarians have said. There's no question that we find, I visited some above Lake Titicaca on the high plateaus of South America and the Andes, where there were dwellings at elevations that are at least a half to a mile higher than habitability in terms of the production of things they needed. And obviously, there was life on these mountains at a high level that proves they were pushed up in recent time, not over the gradual half a hair's breadth of sedimentation and uniformitarianism. Here's a book by D.S. Allen and J.B. Dallaire, Cataclysm, Compelling Evidence of Cosmic Catastrophe. Maybe the finest research book on the subject, I think maybe going beyond Velikovsky. The Bible said it, there were cataclysms. If there is a God, He doesn't have to wait for a Big Bang to roll through 15 billion years. And everybody knows that you put a watch on top of a mountain or in an airplane, it runs at a different pace than the one down here. Gravity affects time. Einstein proved time is relative. Space is relative. All of our concepts are just blown apart periodically. Here is Russell Humphreys, a PhD, has written a little book, Interesting Theories, Starlight and Time, in which he goes through with, he's a profound Hebrew scholar, and he goes through Hebrew words for day, and the ones that are used in the Genesis, the so-called days. And if heaven is a place where there is no light, because the Lamb is the light, when the Spirit was hovering over the face of the waters, and God says, let there be light, He can turn it on and turn it off at will. And whatever the source of the life, the earth was rotating. And there would be darkness and there would be light, and we don't know how long the day was. And one smart aleck in one book lost his faith because he saw that there was day and night before God created the sun and the moon, so therefore it couldn't be accurate. No, there was light and darkness and a rotating earth, and there was light with day and dark with night, and then God began to create. But when he talks about light at its source and the beginning of time and when God created, it's whose watch are you wearing? Which calendar are you talking about? We've already said if you were a photon on a light that's going 186,000 miles a second, it's timeless to you. It's the same time. All the time. You're going 186,000 miles a second. It's the same time all the time. Now, there is no time in God. He's the Alpha and Omega. The scientists have proven time's relative to here, and it changes with location. Well, 186,000 miles a second. A second on which ticker? And which ticker where in the universe? Whose second are we talking about? There's a cute little book, Starlight Time. We don't know! That's the point. Of all generations, this should be the generation that says, oh, the wonder of it, we've explored it every direction. And poor old Einstein, he's part of the EPR experiment, where a particle, two particles separated, move one, spin one, instantly, faster than the speed of light if it's a billion light years away. The other particle acts. Somehow they're connected. As though there's an intelligence undergirding this whole universe. Well, I got a Bible for that. In the beginning was the Word. And all things are consisting by the Word. And the day will come when the Word will rearrange it all and recreate it all new. And there'll be no time there. God was before time, and He'll be after time. And the God of the forefront, as I preach in one of the nitro pills, you have to turn time around. What is future to us has already passed by Him. These things merely illustrate the magnificence of what God created as the place where He was going to start over, having called their names, He would start over and say, let us make man in our image. And Eden, the first place He put them, the Garden of Eden, Eden means heart of God. And Satan, who had disrupted the universe previously, who had disrupted the heavens, who had his pipes and tabrets created in him from the beginning, who was the song leader of praise in heaven and became lifted up in pride. As Jesus said, I saw him cast down, and a third of the angels, the Holy Spirit's brooding over the wreck that became a waste and desolation. And says, let's make man in our image. Puts him in the garden, gave him power over everything. And instead of recognizing this which God hath made, will do anything, like Adam and Eve who hid from His presence, anything to get God out of His universe and make ourselves supreme. We will do anything but bow before His grace and worship Him and live thankfully. God doesn't like it. And at some point, He lifts the capacity to even see Him. And professing to be wise, we become fools. And we have substituted icons that decay for the uncorruptible God. Therefore, the last line begins my next message. I could go on forever on this scientism, but I want to move on to the further results. Wherefore, God also gave them up. Three times He'll say that in the passages that follow. Today, if you can still hear His voice, you still have a God sense at all, if you're still capable of recognizing God's not on trial, He already proved Himself. We're the ones that He expects to bow in reverence before the display of His handiwork, and failure to do it is to get His wrath right now. Thank God for His grace if you are one of those recognizing Him and saying thank you for every breath that you breathe in this magnificent universe that He placed us in order that we might learn about Him and follow Him. And that's my message.